This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. This past week saw the tech sector get rocked as the Federal Reserve signaled interest rate hikes sooner than many of us expected.
The minutes from the FOMC's latest policy meeting added fuel to one of the most intense sell-offs since the financial crisis, as the central bank tries to get a grip on inflation.
Coming up, we'll explore what policymakers can do to help more people effectively compete in a fast-changing economy. We'll do that with Glenn Hubbard. He's Dean Emeritus of the Columbia Business School.
And for some insight into how to better manage your personal finances with more investing options than ever before, we speak to Boston University Professor of Economics Larry Kotlikoff. He unveils his secrets to creating, quote, money magic.
Turning upside down conventions when it comes to finances and how to manage them. Hey, and also a self-made executive who was looking to capitalize on the cutting edge of the metaverse technology for her clients. We're going to check in with Elite World Group CEO Julia Hart, breaking down the next wave of monetization in the digital world.
All that and more to come. We begin, though, with a look at this week's issue of the magazine. Let's welcome in the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's Joel Weber. Hey, Joel, we're going to get into the story in depth just a little bit later on, but we got to talk about the cover here. Jessica Simpson, how did she end up being on this week's cover of Bloomberg Business Week?
Well, this is a story that we've been interested in for a while because we found out that she had this huge, massive fashion empire, a billion-dollar fashion empire, and had basically given her name over. And then everything kind of went awry, and she found herself in December actually going to bankruptcy court to like basically buy back her name. And so this was, ended up being a little bit of a comeback story. Everybody remembers her from The Newlyweds and from her pop star days. But the business side of that is just a fascinating story. And now she's basically taking back the reins of her name and the company and actually trying to basically like start over again.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting. I feel like it really was almost a business school case study and really learning about, you know, a brand licensing the different players and how it can go right, but then how it can also go wrong. And that's really what this gets into. And really just the specific players in it.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, it's like everything was with the best intentions and then, you know, reality steps in and you know, the partner that you had and had a great relationship with, you know, basically dies and you're left with the aftermath of that. And so what do you do? The story opens us with this incredible scene of her basically giving birth and trying to figure out how to manage her business affairs at the same time. So it's a really powerful one and one that we were thrilled to do on the cover.
So the cover story, Joel, it's all about a very famous woman, but another one of the great features this week, it's about a much larger group of women that make up a key demographic in developing countries that were especially hard hit by COVID's impact. It's called The Lost Girls of COVID. What do we need to know?
This is just a remarkable story by Jill Filipovich. Again, we were just totally blown away by where the story took us. And look, the thesis here is that for the last 25 years or so, we have seen extraordinary progress for girls around the world. And that has been just a major success story as girls have become educated and have access to healthcare. We've seen them basically become economic engines throughout the developing world. What COVID does has done and is continuing to do is actually undo a lot of those gains. And the story takes us, Joe's story takes us specifically to Kenya, but it also speaks to, again, what's happening throughout the developing world, where, and in Jill's story, we have young women, teenagers who basically no longer could go to be educated, end up having to be young mothers, which takes them out of the economic progress that they would have previously been able to experience. That's a wrenching story, and it's just a little microcosm of something that is being wrought around the world, sort of invisibly right now, but will have massive implications in the coming decades.
Got to say, what jumped out at me, a reminder that, you know, the whole idea of delaying pregnancy, it's the leading killer of young women in the developing world. I mean, there was one stat in there, Joel, about teen pregnancy rates in some Kenyan countries tripling in the first few months of the pandemic, and some early numbers indicating that adolescent maternal deaths and stillbirths increasing during that same period, like things that maybe we take for granted in the developed world typically, you know, about not getting pregnant when you're a teenager, or, you know, if you do give birth, you're not going to die typically from it. But, you know, the developing world and the pandemic just exacerbating these problems.
Yeah, and I think that just speaks to a fascinating part of the story to me, which is, look, like, there's clearly the health story that mm-hmm. we can talk about all day long and have been for going on 2 years now. But there's going to be these knock-on effects, some of which we are beginning to understand now as the story shows, and then other ones that we're just not going to understand.
Yeah.
The legacy of something like the pandemic could end up being completely different than anything that has to do with health like the specific health effects of COVID, as the story shows. And so it's just a fascinating one that we should be aware of and just recognize that there are a lot of nuances that are going to become apparent. And this one just showed me, like, I had no idea, but it's just heartbreaking when you think about the progress that has been made and is at jeopardy now.
Joel, thank you so much. Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber.
Well, coming up, an economist's guide to personal finance. Boston University professor and New York Times bestselling author Larry Kotlikoff reveals his money secrets. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
It's a new year. It's a time when we all make resolutions about a lot of stuff, right, Tim? I mean, some we keep, some not so much. And if you've made a resolution involving a personal finance makeover, our next guest is someone you'll want to hear from.
Larry Kotlikoff is a Harvard-trained economist, New York Times bestselling author, a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, also a professor of economics at Boston University.
And his new book, he's got one out. It came out this past week. It's called Money Magic, An Economist's Secrets to More Money, Less Risk, and a Better Life. Some of what he says will definitely surprise you.
So what is the biggest thing that we're getting wrong when it comes to conventional wisdom when thinking about retirement?
Well, there's so many things we're getting wrong. We're not saving enough. We're retiring too early. We're taking Social Security too early. We think we should get out of the stock market in old age, when economics actually says you should, as you're going through retirement, you should be putting a larger and larger share of your dwindling retirement assets, you know, fungible assets, into stocks.
Tim and I were just talking about this. Remember when it used to be like your age minus, and that would, you know, figure out how much should be in fixed income versus the equity markets? Anyway, please continue.
That's another one of the rules of dumb of the conventional financial planning. But we also need to understand that we should be timing the market for risk. When things are riskier like they are right now, we don't know what the economy is going to be able to absorb all the illness from Omicron, even though, you know, any one person may not be as likely to die, you know, that's more risk. So we should be cutting back on our stock holdings in times of risk.
So
that's actually what we see happening.
When you sat down to write this book, why did you want to do it specifically? Because you really talk about, when it comes to living standards and these financial decisions that we can make can really impact our living standards going forward.
Yeah, Wall Street is focused on our wealth, and economists are focused on our welfare. Our welfare connects to what we get to spend and our living standard. And economists have been working on personal finance for 100 years, starting with the work of Irving Fisher in the 1920s, the Yale professor. So I got into grad school in economics because I wanted to help. I thought it could be a field that could help society. And I realized, working a lot on personal financial issues, that what was being conveyed to the public as advice was complete right angles, completely at odds with what economics was recommending on every area, whether how much to save, when to retire, when to take Social Security, how to think about your longevity risk. Just completely across the board, it was all oriented towards product sales when it came from conventional planning, economics. And then you had economists basically never talking to the public, because They didn't have a clear idea of what precisely to say, and they didn't think it was their job to actually prescribe solutions. But I've been working in developing personal financial software. We have a tool called Maxify.com, M-A-X-I-F-I.com, that I've been working on for 30 years developing the software, which does deliver the economic solution. But most people don't want to run software. So I said, let me take everything I've learned over the years from economists, from the software, from my own research, put it into this book, and that's where I'm coming from to help people.
So I'm just at Max. I'm looking at the planner right now. It's really interesting, Larry. I'm wondering, how people can put your lessons into practice. I mean, what's a practical way to think about the advice that you've learned over your career?
Well, I mean, the book, if they bought the book, if they don't want to actually, run the software, they buy the book. The lessons from the software are primarily, mostly in the book. What we're trying to figure out in economics is how to have a smooth living standard, how to raise your living standard safely, like doing smart things with respect to Social Security and retirement accounts to lower your lifetime taxes, how to price decisions. If I'm thinking about buying a new boat, how much is that going to cost me? A big boat. Not a new boat, but a big boat.
Yeah.
How much is that really going to cost me in terms of my ongoing living standards? So I need to understand that trade-off in order to decide whether it's worth it to me. So pricing risk, but also when it comes to investment, understanding the range of my living standard outcomes. Wall Street is focused on your saving what you're currently saving, you're spending some targeted amount that has no connection to what you actually can afford, and then accumulating this stuff up on a Monte Carlo simulation, simulating whether or not you run out of money. But economics says you're going to adjust your spending all the time.
Right.
And so therefore, we have to look at the trajectory of your living standard path.
So tell us about some of the other thinkings that you get into your book. And you talk about specifically, you get into Social Security. You talk about, something that Tim and I have talked a lot about. I just sent a daughter off to college. Higher education, especially from private institutions, it's really expensive. You're talking $70,000-$80,000 a year.
Yeah, yeah. And I say, I have a chapter entitled Don't Borrow for College. There's a chapter on, Married for Money. There's a chapter title about divorce, how to divorce without going to divorce war. So the book really covers the entire gamut of personal financial decisions. As for college, there's evidence that going to Harvard relative to some other university is not going to matter much to your career earnings, because it's how well you work and how diligently and how creative you are. I mean, Harvard collects really special people who are very good at working, very hard, and also are talented in other ways, but it doesn't necessarily add any value to them. So why should you pay for $70,000 a year when you can, have the same career if you go to Wake Forest at a much lower price? I'm not sure Wake Forest is cheaper, actually, so I'm just throwing that example out. But that's the idea. Let's shop around for a school that's affordable. 40% of the kids that go to college never finish. So if you borrow for the luxury of dropping out of college, this is crazy. Who borrows money to invest in something where they know right at the get-go there's a 40% chance of getting nothing?
Hmm. Yeah, that's it. No,
so that's why there's a chapter called Don't Borrow for College. It's very strong, strong language warning people off from this.
That was BU Professor of Economics Larry Kotlikoff. His new book, Money Magic, An Economist's Secrets to More Money, Less Risk, and a Better Life. It's out now.
By the way, later on, something perhaps to help you with your New Year's weight loss and fitness resolutions. We're going to check in on the app Strava. And in keeping with that, still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, prescription weight loss drugs are working. So why is it so hard to get your hands on them?
The story behind effective medicines that most doctors, they're not prescribing and insurers aren't covering. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Obesity, it's a disease, and there are definitely ways to fight it, including prescription drugs that work. The problem is most doctors are not prescribing them, and insurers, they are not footing the bills.
We're talking about GLP-1s, and to help us understand what exactly they do, what they are, and why they're important, we're joined by Bloomberg News healthcare reporter Emma Court. She wrote the piece. She joined us along with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber.
Doctors have this stigma around it. It's like it still, in their mind, can be a behavioral problem that science can't necessarily solve. Insurance, on top of that, looks at this new class of drug, and they're not necessarily throwing money at it. All of which, you know, kind of leaves this solution to a big problem somewhat on the shelf. But now I'm talking out of turn, and I want to hear more from Emma. So, Emma, what how did this story come into being, and what kind of potential does this class of drugs really have?
The piece started, there were a couple of early threads, but I started hearing about some startups that were trying to treat obesity and help people with weight loss using medication and telemedicine. So these like virtual doctor's visits. And I thought it was sort of an interesting approach. And at the same time, with hearing about pharmaceutical companies trying to develop better obesity drugs. And, you know, as I learned more about the space, I just kept coming back to this point of like, you know, even previous to these GLP-1 drugs that are starting to be developed for weight loss and obesity specifically, they were previously been used in diabetes. There have been prescription drugs that can help people lose weight that are rarely used. You know, and this is going back several years, and there's a lot of different complicated reasons for that. But I kept kind of just being struck by this discrepancy between the fact that, you know, many people are obese or overweight in the U.S., you know, hundreds of millions of people. And yet people are consistently being told to diet, to exercise, and they're not being told about this other option that's available for them.
All right, Emma, the thing I find like crazy, like blows my mind a little bit is, and you write this, the biggest constraint on weight loss drugs remains buy-in from the broader medical industry. How can doctors who potentially see this as something that could really, like prescribing one of these drugs, help one of their obese patients, how are they allowed, you know, as a doctor not to prescribe it?
That's a really good question, Carol. And I think, you know, I quote a doctor, an obesity doctor in the story who says sort of, you know, if you treated diabetes or hypertension in this way, like, you know, a doctor would lose their medical license. I mean, it's kind of remarkable that, you know, we're very comfortable prescribing, and by the way, I mean doctors prescribing medications for so many different kinds of medical conditions. And I think a lot of this has to do with the way obesity has previously been seen, right? People think of obesity or being overweight as really being a something that you kind of did to yourself, right? And we kind of get into this more in the piece, but you didn't work hard enough to lose weight, right? This is your fault. As a result, this is treated as a lifestyle condition. It's you're eating too much, you're not active enough. There's some more complicated science that's come out in the last several decades that shows that our bodies really do have a big influence over how we, you know, when we stop eating, you know, when we're hungry, when we feel satisfied after we eat, and that there's more biologically going on than merely sort of, you know, refraining from getting on the treadmill every day, which is what I think a lot of people unfortunately still think, and even doctors and certainly people who struggle with their weight themselves.
Well, I'm just going to make one comment because I know Tim has a question, but I wrote a note. Being obese is big business and it supports a lot that's out there. Anyway, that's my opinion piece there.
It does, and it's a good, I mean, it's a good thing for us to be thinking about in the new year when a lot of people have different fitness goals and weight loss goals that are associated with the new year. I want to talk a little bit more about that, Emma, and obesity, because I'm always shocked to see these statistics about, you know, how many Americans are obese or overweight. 3 in 4, an estimated 245 million people. Can you talk a little bit though about comorbidities here and the dangers of being overweight? They've come to the surface a lot when in discussions of COVID, but beyond that,
the big kind of concern about having excess weight is obviously that's defined by the body mass index standard, right? So people who are obese are at higher risk of developing various medical conditions, including diabetes, another risk that's tied to obesity is actually all-cause mortality. So literally death by any cause.
That was Bloomberg News healthcare reporter Emma Court. Find more stories from the current issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's online at businessweek.com, on the Bloomberg terminal, and also on newsstands. She, by the way, wrote the piece. Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber joined us for that conversation as well.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Coming up next, at an uncertain moment for the global economy, our next guest says that policymakers, well, they need to be bold.
He has some specific ideas. Later on, too, pop star Jessica Simpson's bold move to reclaim her company and her own name. It's a great story. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
This week, we got the minutes from the Federal Reserve's last meeting of 2021. Those minutes indicating the central bank is ready to speed up the timeline for raising interest rates. Our next guest thinks the FOMC has been a little bit slow with its policy decisions of late.
Glenn Hubbard is Dean Emeritus and Professor of Finance and Economics at Columbia Business School. He's also the former chairman of the U.S. Council of Economic Advisors. He was that under President George W. Bush.
He was Dean when you were at the Columbia Business School.
He was. That's why I still have to call him Dean Hubbard. I just, you know, it's what I called him then and what I'll call him forever, probably.
It makes a lot of sense. By the way, to be fair, we caught up with him earlier in the week. That was before those FOMC meeting minutes came out and really rocked the financial markets. We had him on, though, to talk about his new book. That book is out later this month. It is called The Wall and the Bridge, Fear and Opportunity in Disruption's Wake. In it, Dean Hubbard lays out a path to a brighter economic future. It all begins with the need for sound decisions in the near term.
The inflation concerns, I think, are real. I think monetary policy has been behind the curve, and we've spent probably too much time on demand and not enough time on getting supply chains right and supply right. So I think that can still sort itself out, but it's definitely a worry. I worry, you know, the sort of the theme in the book as well, that there's some slower moving things that are even more dangerous for our economy. Big positive changes in technology and globalization that leave many of us quite much better off, but make some of us worse off, and our politics and our economics are affected.
So the question is, Dean Hubbard, what are the solutions that you propose to tackle some of these big picture challenges that, by the way, are much bigger than what we think about with the Omicron variant or even getting beyond this pandemic? I mean, the genesis of this goes back to before President Trump was elected.
Oh, sure. We're thinking about decades of change that, again, have been largely positive for the American economy. We all celebrate technological advance and globalization. But for many individuals and many communities, the news has not been so positive. You know, chances are when anyone listening to this took Econ 101, I hope they liked the course, and their professor probably said something like, you know, technological advance, trade makes us better off, and then probably mumbled something because the gainers can compensate the losers. The problem is we haven't been doing that. And you asked about solutions, and I think there are big, bold things we can do to build bridges, to help people compete in the world, which would be everything from bold support for community colleges and training, support for low-wage work in the country, and most importantly, an attitude shift in Washington and in the economics profession that notices these things. It goes all the way back to what Adam Smith would have taught us, founder of economics. We really, really need to help people compete.
Well, it's interesting. First of all, music to our ears. I have a degree in economics. I went to Barnard College, worked actually at the business school. Tim has an MBA from Columbia Business School and was there when you were dean.
That's why I have to call you Dean. I can't even call you Dean Emeritus.
Bless you both.
So we're all in on this. You know, I do think about some of the gaps and divisions that we have in our society, certainly exacerbated by the pandemic. But, you know, innovation, embracing it, like not everybody has been able to benefit by all the disruption and innovation out there. Your ideas and what you write about in this book about bridges versus walls, how can that help more people benefit in our society and our economy?
Another great question. Here's the problem. Walls are very seductive. They're very seductive for politicians to tell people, I'm going to protect you. I'm going to protect you from trade or from immigration or from technological advance. But they, the flip side of a wall is I'm also protecting you from all the good things that come from all of that. The right answer to the wall isn't what economists often talk about, which is just let the market rip, kind of laissez-faire, if you will. The right answer is building bridges. And I think if we focus on, A, preparing people to compete in the world that is and will be, and reconnect them when they fall out of the economic boat, that's important. You know, classical economists like Smith always felt that the goal of an economy is mass flourishing. It's everyone participating. That should be our moral and our economic imperative. We've got to push back on the wall.
Dean Hubbard, we just have about a minute and a half, and then we'll do some more news and come back some more. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, you do in your book about building bridges. Who best builds those bridges that we need today? Is it politicians? Is it corporate leaders? Who is it?
I think it's all of the above. Business leaders have to understand that social support for the system, meaning market capitalism, isn't a given. And business leaders need to acknowledge that and pitch in. In the book, I talk about examples like George Eastman, of business leaders who built entire communities largely for their own business, but also to help others. Government needs to begin by just noticing the problem and looking at what worked in the past, like the land-grant colleges or the GI Bill. So it's really all of the above.
Is there the political will to get that done in Washington, though?
Well, the cheap answer would be to say no, but I say yes. And the reason I say yes is we're having a sterile debate over capitalism versus socialism as opposed to solving people's problems. There is a huge opportunity for a leader, be he or she a Democrat or a Republican, to come in and say, you know what? I can make people and communities better off. That's a winner.
How has the pandemic, you were already writing this book and you note that, and then the pandemic hit. How has that impacted your thinking and your writing?
Well, the pandemic, of course, you know, makes it clear that there's not one single labor market. There are some individuals who use technology to work at home. There are many Americans for whom that's not a real possibility. And not just the pandemic today, but the future from artificial intelligence and machine learning to the adaptation of the economy to fight climate change, these are all things that suggest really big structural shifts about to happen, and we really need to get ahead of them in a way we didn't get ahead of earlier technological changes or globalization.
You know, we talk a lot about incentives, and we talk about market incentives. We learn a lot about incentives in business school, and I'm wondering what the incentives are for policymakers to actually make these types of changes, because I think many people could argue that a lot of them look short term, right? 2 years, an election cycle, 6 years perhaps, or 4 years for presidents. What are the incentives here for policymakers?
Well, I think many policymakers think this is all just too hard to do. It's easier just to throw out words like let's build a wall. The problem with that is it's not too hard to do. In the middle of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln launched the land-grant colleges, the Homestead Act, the Transcontinental Railroad. I think that was a pretty tough time for decision making. As World War II was coming to a close, we certainly did the GI Bill for welcoming service people coming home. So we can do this. I think a politician who figures out that these sort of structural fixes actually help a lot of people probably finds political gold, not just economic gold.
You have a great line in your book. An overarching lesson for economic policy is the greater the benefits of disruption from openness, the more gainers should compensate losers, because disruption innovation, right? We certainly don't want to stop it. It has created some incredible things, but people, industry, things are impacted, people, individuals, right? And we need to not just ignore that.
Well, and to not ignore it means to notice it. You know, I comment in the book, my wife has always had this great categorization of the world into two groups, economists and real people. She always reminds me that, you know, economists tend to think about all these benefits of things, but we never really process what's happening to a lot of individuals and communities. politicians are real people, but they need our help in noticing this.
That's Glenn Hubbard, Dean Emeritus, Professor of Finance and Economics at Columbia Business School. I have to say, Tim, what I loved is there's stuff in the book where you were there, you know, at the business school, you know, hearing those presentations and those meetings. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. There was this, and this is partly what the book is based on, this one, this big talk that Dean Hubbard gave along with the professor Ray Horton, who was my professor at the time as well, about populism. And it was ahead of the 2016 election, just 5 days before the 2016 election. I think it's fair to say the results of that surprised a lot of people.
Yeah, and definitely ahead of the curve on that one. Hey, by the way, he was previously the chairman of the U.S. Council of Economic Advisors. That was under President George W. Bush. He also serves on the boards of ADP, BlackRock Fixed Income Funds, and also on MetLife.
And one more time, his new book, The Wall and the Bridge, Fear and Opportunity in Disruption's Wake. That comes out later this month.
That wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec. Coming up in our next hour, a nascent media powerhouse looking to carve out virtual space for her clients in the metaverse.
All about the metaverse, apparently, Tim.
Yeah.
We're still figuring it out.
I'm still living in real life.
Me too. I'm trying to, at least.
I'm old school.
I'm trying to amid COVID. Also, a fitness app looks to expand beyond high-level athletes by breaking an important barrier. But this is all about you sign up in January, make a resolution.
You just got to hold it till January 17th. But I got to tell you, I didn't work out this morning, and that was on my list of things to do.
Yeah, but so, you're a loyal user of the app.
I am.
Right?
I'm a loyal user of the app, yeah. Maybe after work today.
All right. Well, you're a loyal user of the app. Have you done any traveling lately?
No. But I'm planning to next week.
Well, Pursuits actually addresses that.
All right. We're going to go around the world with our Bloomberg Pursuits team.
Like all the places you want to check out maybe in 2022 when it comes to travel. Up next, though, first, we're going to get to our cover story, how pop star, once reality star, then business mogul Jessica Simpson built a billion-dollar business, lost it, and then bought it back.
Chicken of the sea, anyone?
If you don't know that reference, you're going to have to stick around for that story.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including the next big thing in fashion, a believer of metaverse technology laying out her vision of success. We're going to catch up with Elite World Group CEO Julia Hart.
Plus, the next big challenge for the popular fitness app Strava and an optimistic peek at trips to plan in the coming year. You know, once this whole pandemic blows over as we enter year three of it. We're going to have a travel takeover from our team at Bloomberg Pursuits.
I got to say, there's so many places on that list
Where would you go?
Where would I go first? Yeah. I want to do some diving.
Oh, yeah.
To be quite honest.
That's true. That makes sense.
Love to go on a safari, too. First up, though, let's get to this week's cover story about the entertainer turned businesswoman that licensed out her name for an array of retail products. She did really well. It became a $1 billion business. Until it wasn't doing well. We're talking about the chicken of the sea pop star, Jessica Simpson.
Now, Carol, I know you're a fan of the Newlyweds, that reality show.
Long time ago.
Yeah, long time ago. very long time ago, right?
Sorry.
But it's still, I mean, look, I think still a lot of people remember Jessica Simpson from that and from her music as well. But let's get into how things went awry for Simpson. We're going to do that with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber, also with Bloomberg News high yield and distressed credit reporter Eliza Reynolds-Hannon.
Yeah, well, she fell into the brand management industry where, you know, because it's so difficult for celebrities to finance their own endeavors, they often are the clients or part of the portfolio of a company that specializes in owning brands. But as part of that model, which many say is not sustainable, those companies really buy the brands to run them out and they don't reinvest. So it's really a demonstration of how unsustainable that model is and how it may be, in fact, more valuable for the face behind the brand to have more of an active stake in what's happening in order for it to kind of reflect all the potential they have.
Eliza, I'm curious. You know, I always love talking to people after reading these stories because I can learn how the sausage was made. But I'm wondering how, you know, you cover high yield and distressed credit. And how did you come to find yourself writing about Jessica Simpson?
Well, it fell into my purview because the only way that she was able to get her brand back was because the you know, the parent company, which is part of this unsustainable model, had to file for bankruptcy. And, you know, in the bankruptcy auction phase, the assets, you know, were available for purchase. So she already owned half of, you know, a little bit less than half of the equity stake in her own business, but this gave her the opportunity to buy the rest of it and on the cheap as well, because assets in bankruptcy are always, you know, a little bit discounted.
How does this go down? You lose your name. Where do you go from there? Because all roads lead to Delaware when that happens, right?
Well, I mean, it was a very conscious and, you know, potentially arguably savvy decision that she made back in 2015 when her business partner at the time, Vince Camuto, who helped finance the operation and also licensed and manufactured some of the goods, he died. She needed, you know, a capital injection in order to take her business to the next step. And, you know, it's hard to get financing in the public markets, as we know, and it's, you know, she's not quite big enough of an operation to necessarily be able to conduct a fundraising process herself or within her business. So you tap one of these brand management companies in order to, you know, when they buy you, you get a lot of that cash, and you also get arguably a parent company who's going to be invested in your success. Now, those companies are publicly traded, and they are under all the same pressures as any company is to deliver on margin projections, and, you know, they often end up cutting corners and really just wringing dry their assets and then kind of casting them aside.
You do get into the players. Like, I had no idea that Camuto had such a big role in building up this company, and he really was kind of a godfather to all of them. And her mother, too, where we know parents, when it comes to younger folks, can either be a detriment or helpful.
Well, look at her dad.
Exactly.
And the impact that her dad had on her career.
Yeah.
And, you know, even in the case of Camuto, it was actually his son who first told him to look into working with Jessica Simpson. So it really is a multi-generational affair, this whole story.
I think when people, Eliza, see that a celebrity is associated with a brand or has their own brand, people often ask the question about, you know, how much is this individual who we know from, you know, stage and screen and Newlyweds, right, Carol?
Yeah.
Involved in day-to-day operations of the business and how much is sort of other people do. How would you describe Jessica Simpson's involvement right now?
Well, like Joel said, her mother is really the biggest brains behind the operation. She's been extremely involved since day one, and she's certainly got a head for business, and she and Jessica work really closely with a team that's not really that big. I mean, I think at one point there were only 8 of them or so when they were owned by Sequential Brands, but, you know, they have a lot of help, because one of the things that's important to know is that the business itself, the operations that are required are pretty limited, because you're not actually manufacturing the goods, and you are, you know, there's a lot of the supply chain that is outsourced through the licensing process.
That was Bloomberg News high yield and distressed credit reporter Eliza Reynolds-Hannon. She co-wrote this week's cover story with Stephanie Clifford. Our big thanks, of course, to Business Week editor Joel Weber as well.
It's a great read, and I highly recommend. We just touched on it, but there's so much detail in the story. There are things I didn't know. I knew the brand. I'd seen it in various retailers, but how it was built up and just all of the kind of business comings and goings behind it and all the individuals involved. And I had no idea her mom was so involved.
I had no idea about any of it, really. It was one of those stories, right? Where, of course, I knew Jessica Simpson because, we're kind of the same, you know, generation.
Yeah.
So I grew up knowing her music and, of course, knowing her celebrity, but I had no idea about the business side.
You weren't buying the Daisy Duke shorts?
I wasn't.
Or cowboy boots? Okay.
Yeah, it was popular after the movie. Another thing I learned in that story, Carol.
All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, how a talent agency plans to morph into a media powerhouse in the metaverse. Yeah, it's happening, I guess. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Our next guest is looking to turn models into brands through digital platforms and in doing so increase their career longevity. She's also working with brands, really well-known ones, in developing their own digital strategies.
Julia Hart is co-owner and CEO of the talent representation company Elite World Group. It represents about 5,400 clients globally. Her all-star roster includes Tiffany, Chanel, Prada, Burberry, Kendall Jenner, Adriana Lima, more. A group that's said to reach nearly 2 billion social media users worldwide.
That
that's a pretty big social footprint.
Yeah, almost as many followers as you have on Twitter, right, Carol?
Yeah, in my dreams. Yeah. It's too much work, too much work. Julia is also the subject of the Netflix series. You might have seen it. It's called My Unorthodox Life. It premiered this past summer. She joined Tim and me to break down her company's path from modeling agency to metaverse media giant.
The only reason I took over the company is because I realized with the advent of social media, we are at the forefront of changing the way that people communicate and how people advertise. Because if you think about it, social media advertising by definition has to be more honest, right? Julia Hart, who's 5 feet tall and can barely lift her handbag, is not going to be doing an ad for a workout session with weights.
You might so in the metaverse, though, but we can talk about that later.
So what I understood is that you think of the talent, instead of thinking of them as athletes or actors or models, to me, those are all platforms, whether it's a runway, a tennis court, a football stadium, a movie set, it doesn't matter. We utilize that and put the power in their hands. It's this massive shift in the power dynamic and this vast democratization of fashion, because for the first time, it's not the talent having to run and hope that someone chooses them, that a creative director likes them, that a photographer or videographer takes them under their wing, that some editor of a fancy magazine wants to have a photo of them. Their career is in their hands. And so what we're doing is we're helping them create themselves into brands and businesses. We utilize the time that they're in the public eye to build them into brands so that far past the time they're on whatever platform they started from, whether it's a tennis court or a runway or a football stadium, their audiences become so accustomed to coming to them, they will continue. They are the media. They have the audience. Our aggregated viewership has now reached 2.2 billion people.
Help us understand the connection to technology here, because you use terms like platform and audience, and I think, you know, influencer, right? I think Instagram, I think YouTube. How is that married into this?
The way that I looked at it when I took over, because to me, the modeling industry was not interesting at all. It felt like the flip side of the world that I came from. The only reason I took it over is because I realized that I have the possibility to make an army of financially independent women by utilizing their social media channels as actual networks.
What I'm wondering too, and I look at how my daughter, 18, you know, how she shops, you know, what she looks at, it's all through a lot of Instagram. It's all social media. It's very different from how I shopped. But I do wonder, not everybody's going to be, we did a story earlier about Jessica Simpson, you know, and kind of built an incredible brand, got away from her, and she just got it back and she's trying to rebuild it. But not everybody will have success. Are you saying that everybody will have success on social media?
Great question. Of course, everyone will not have success. So there's two ingredients, what we provide and what the talent provides. So when I thought of talent as media, and I realized that if I literally treat them as media, they have the power. They're not waiting for the casting agents and the creative directors. They are now being chased by the casting agents and creative directors because they bring the audience, right? I always tell every talent, find your angel product. And it doesn't actually mean it has to be a physical thing. It means something that you are truthfully passionate about, that people know when they come on your website, on your Instagram page or your TikTok or whatever, they're going to learn more about X. If you love the environment, talk about the environment. Show all of the different environmental, you know, places that you belong with and what you're doing. Let people understand who you are. And that's the first time in history that tennis players and models and, you know, athletes can say who they are. And it's not just about what they do.
Tell us a little bit about, though, we want to talk about the metaverse.
Yeah.
And what do you see? Because I think, Julia, safe to say, you know, we've all been obsessed with what Facebook, or formerly known as Facebook, you know, Meta is up to, and how this will fit into our world more broadly. How do you see it in terms of talent and branding? Because Tim and I recently caught up with our Pursuits team and Chris Rouser, and we talked about the high-end fashion houses that you work with that are selling fashion NFTs for thousands of dollars. So our world is evolving.
Indeed it is. And honestly, to me, metaverse and avatars, way before, you know, Facebook called itself Meta, right? In 2019, I started building my team of avatar creators and metaverse experts. I started literally building the whole concept of metaverse and avatars a month and a half after I took over as CEO, because to me, it was an evolution of what's going on in the digital space. And by that, I mean, think about what is the most watched show on NBC, right? The most watched show on NBC gets around 3-4 million viewers. My talent gets 50 million viewers while they're mowing their lawn. They have the audience. So the first thing was to give them longevity. And by giving them longevity, I mean turning them into brands. And we did that by bringing in-house what networks have.
That's Julia Hart, the co-owner and CEO of the talent representation company Elite World Group.
When it comes to metaverse, what do you think about it? Or do you just feel like we're just so early in?
You know, I got to tell you, I think about Facebook and I think about Facebook's rebrand to Meta.
Yeah.
I think about the work that it's doing on Oculus. But I had an interesting conversation this week with Katie Greifeld, my co-anchor at Quick Take Stock. She was talking about how, wasn't this what we were doing when we were playing Nintendo Wii, years ago and playing Wii Tennis, having these avatars of us that were doing what we were doing in the real world, they were doing on the screen? We're wondering about branding here.
Yeah, I'm a little confused. I don't know. And does it just become that much more, like, I think about Pong games early on that were pretty basic. So does it become something that's much more detailed and an experience of some sort? I don't know.
It's a good point.
You have a funny look on your face.
Well, it's because I'm not quite in it, you know?
Come on.
I'm skeptical.
Come to the Meta side.
I'm skeptical.
All right. I'm just going to stick to my Meta meditation. Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, Tim, a story you're pretty excited about, fitness app Strava in the spotlight.
Yeah, this is a startup that's been around for years. Mm-hmm. It's big in the cycling and long-distance running communities. And I learned a little bit about the future of the company, and Max Chafkin got some numbers for once from the company about how much revenue they're doing and, you know, little profitability hints as well.
What's interesting is they seem to be holding on to users. It's not just a pandemic play, right?
Right, exactly. So kind of the opposite of a Peloton-like company.
All right, that's coming up next. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Tim, you are definitely stoked for the story.
I am. I'm a Strava user.
So tell us about Strava.
Okay, so Strava is, it's been around for years, and it's a fitness platform that's mainly used by cyclists and distance runners.
Serious people, though.
Yeah, serious athletes. But, you know, it's still a private company, and it still has an IPO'd. And I've been wondering, hey, what's going on with Strava? So I was really happy to read this story from Max Chafkin. He is a features editor for Bloomberg Business Week. By the way, Max is also this. Every time I talk about Max, we got to talk about his Peter Thiel book, because it's a fantastic book. So be sure to check that out. He's the author of that new book. Came out just a few.
The Contrarian.
Peter
Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power.
Yeah, it came out just a few months ago. Max joins us now. He's features editor for Bloomberg Business Week. Max, January 17th. That's the day I have to make it. I have to make it to, right?
Yeah, Quitter's Day. Thanks for that introduction. Yeah, so Strava, as you said, you know, it's an app that has, you know, really well known in the kind of serious athlete world, although it is, and partly because of the pandemic, I think, has sort of taken off in kind of more casual fitness circles. They've seen, you know, huge user growth over the last couple of years, as we report in this story. And of course, besides the pandemic, there is a sort of a cyclical nature to the fitness business, where in early January, right about this time, you know, everyone makes these New Year's resolutions. And as I think a lot of people know, New Year's resolutions do not stick very well. Strava, being a tech company, can really, you know, dig into the data and slice and dice it. And they, the CEO told me that basically January 17th, that's the day that where you kind of separate the New Year's resolution quitters from the ones who stick it out for a long period of time. That's when most of the sort of traffic is going to fall off. But he said, kind of on the bright side, those who do make it past that January 17th date, at least on Strava, seem to stick around for a lot longer, seem to kind of form more permanent fitness habits.
Well, and I guess they've had a test too. Like, you know, we talk about Peloton so much, right? Everybody who was leaning in big time and buying up Pelotons during the pandemic when they couldn't go to gyms and were buying stuff for their home. But we saw, you know, as the world reopened, of course, we're in a little bit of a falling back again because of Omicron. But nonetheless, you know, we saw Peloton then under a lot of pressure for a lot of different reasons, but also people kind of going back out into the world and being able to work outside, you know, work out outside their homes. Has Strava seen the same thing? Like, what happened to it during the pandemic, and has it been able to hold on to users?
Absolutely, yeah. So Strava is another one of these pandemic boom businesses where, you know, stay-at-home orders happen, and there are all these things that people were wanted to do, but they were unable to do, so they looked for digital alternatives. You saw a lot of people, you know, they couldn't go to the gym, so they bought Peloton bikes. Some of those people, you know, downloaded Strava or signed up for a subscription. There's a sort of paid version of it where you get training plans and these competitive leaderboards that are very popular, especially with runners and cyclists. And anyway, so they saw this kind of bump in traffic during the stay-at-home period, just like Peloton, just like many businesses. But as I talk about in this piece, the traffic actually didn't really go away. And you know, I talked to, you know, Strava CEO about that, and his view is basically that, you know, Strava, you know, unlike some of these other services that really were, you know, primarily useful as kind of indoor, stay-at-home type things, you know, of course, I'm sure Peloton now, it's cold outside and everything. I'm sure people are kind of maybe rediscovering their bikes. But Strava, you know, works just as well outdoors and indoors. So kind of an interesting thing that happened, you know, we saw all these big-time races. You know, New York City Marathon went virtual in 2020, and they encouraged people, they had a partnership with Strava, encouraged people to record a virtual marathon, a virtual, you know, 26-mile run in the app. That's, of course, great for Strava as a business. When things reopened this past summer in 2021, you still saw a ton of Strava usage, just people using the app outdoors to track their, you know, outdoor runs, outdoor bike rides. You know, something like half the field at the New York Marathon recorded their race on Strava, and similar data from, you know, the London Marathon, I believe the Boston Marathon as well. So you've kind of seen, instead of this kind of boom and bust thing, just a continued growth. And it's not clear, you know, we don't know how long that's going to last, but Strava's CEO, Michael Horvath, is basically saying, you know, we're not seeing these same headwinds as these other players.
That's Bloomberg Businessweek features editor Max Chafkin. Look for his story in the latest issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's on newsstands now, online at businessweek.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Coming up, oh, the places you'll go, that is, once you can go again. I really dream about this.
Yeah, I do too.
You're getting ready to do some traveling.
Yeah, I mean, look, if I get a negative PCR test 72 hours before leaving, that's the question.
It's tricky, right?
Well, the trickiest part, Carol, is getting the results back within that amount of time, because these testing centers are so overwhelmed right now.
That's what I've heard from a lot of people, that's what's holding them back.
I might be here next week.
I hope you get to go. I know you need a break. All right, everybody, we're going to check in with our Bloomberg Pursuits team on the host of adventures that really await you from Alaska to Zambia. It's all coming up. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Every new watch is like a new piece of art. It has a different story to tell.
Italian wines as a whole really speak to that quintessential need.
It is the most powerful car made in the U.S., period.
You get the beautiful interior, the iconic design.
It's very chic and posh.
Even if you pay for it, it's something that money can't get.
If your travel plans are on hold because of the Omicron variant, well, fear not. Our Bloomberg Pursuits team, they are still going around the globe uncovering the perfect destinations for you to plan your next trip. I love this section.
I do too. A travel takeover. Who doesn't love it? That's what's happening in this week's Pursuits section, produced by our travel editor, Nikki Eckstein and company. So Nikki was actually traveling at the time that we put this broadcast together. She's right now on a plane back from Anguilla. So we went right to her boss. We went to the top, Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser, to tell us what we need to know.
Chris, your team literally all over the world for this series of stories. A big theme of this section is family. I want to get into that in just a moment. But when you're doing this, and you guys do this a lot, you look around the world, how do you kind of put it all together?
You said I was going to tell you what you need to know, and the first thing is that you need to know is that I am not mad at Nikki.
You should
be. Definitely
not
jealous that for 5 days she has been in Anguilla trying restaurants and hotels.
So she's there for work?
Yeah. Oh, she's there for work.
Nikki.
So when we put together these lists, you know, Nikki has a running vast database of every new hotel opening, major restaurants, major tours that are opening up, cruise lines. So we know everything that's going on, especially in the luxury field. And what makes our list a little different from other lists is that we really do focus on luxury access and luxury places to stay and things to do when you're traveling. So take the Amalfi Coast, for example. We feature it this year now. The Amalfi Coast hasn't changed a ton in the past few decades. It's always been a wonderful place to go. But this year in particular, there have been a couple new luxury hotels opening. So that's a reason why that would end up on our list this year. The other thing that we focused on this year was places that you can go to be together. You maybe don't want to go to Oktoberfest, like be with thousands of other people, but, you know, maybe you want to take a family trip and you want to rent out a few tents on a safari and you can go with a big group. Or maybe you want to go to a hotel that specializes in villas so you can rent a little house for your family. Or you go on a sort of a drinking trip with your friends to Wales. So each of these little places has a little bit of a suggestion on how to spend some time with people or just meet locals.
Well, one thing that caught my eye, I mean, this, look, you have places all over the world on this list, but I want to start with somewhere that's a little closer to home for a lot of people. Boca Raton is a cool place to hang out.
Has anybody ever seen Seinfeld? God. Come on, you don't go to Boca.
This is what it says. Hang with your grandparents in suddenly cool Boca Raton.
This is hard for people to believe, but Boca Raton and the area, so Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach, have a bunch of new hotels that kind of compete with big luxury resorts elsewhere, like Baja Mar in the Caribbean. There's a Mandarin Oriental that's going to open up there in the Boca area. And there's some really serious restaurants, like Major Food Group, which does Carbone in New York and Miami. They're doing a takeover of an old golf clubhouse there that's currently called Flamingo Grill. So there's actually like a lot of cool stuff to do there. And it's obviously still as beautiful and sunny as it was when your grandparents were there.
What was the place in Seinfeld, Chris?
Del Boca Vista.
Del Boca Vista, yes.
You can eat early and all. I love it. What I do like too, so much of what's in there, because I've been thinking, I've never done a safari. I would love to do it. There's so much great outside stuff.
Yeah, and you know, a big thing in safaris now is walking safaris. Mm. So you think of a safari, you get in a Jeep, maybe with no top, you go out, you try to see the big five, lions, elephants, hippos. Now, in a couple of the places that we feature, one is in Zambia and the other is KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, you walk around and you're on foot. So you really, you know, it may not seem like it's for everybody, and it may not be for me, but it's a very incredible way to get up close with some of these animals. And particularly some of the walking safaris really focus on birds, so it's not as, carnivore focused. Mm-hmm. But also these safari outlets are really conservation focused, especially the ones that we feature. And so you can go, oftentimes you can rent a small group of tents together for your family or your group of friends. And then you learn about conservation and you can actually help with conservation. And the funds that your trip supply actually go towards protecting the animals that you want to go and see.
I love that, the kind of ecotourism. I've done some trips, yoga trips, where it's you plant trees while you're there.
Yeah, that's really cool.
I was going to say, though, the walking tour, Tim, I was thinking about you and the story we just talked about with Max Chafkin and Strava. That if you are on Strava and you're a serious athlete, a runner, a cyclist, you could probably do that walking tour because you could run really fast away from the animals.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say probably, running. Hey, I want to talk a little bit about the next it place, Romania. Why did you guys choose this part of the world to call the next it place?
Wait, what?
So Romania actually was, before the pandemic and before I had a child, Romania was on our list of where my husband and I wanted to go. And, you know, most people, if they think about Romania, they think about Transylvania. And so actually one of the biggest tour groups in Romania is called Beyond Dracula, because
there's
a nationwide investment in getting you to know more about the country other than that. And, you know, it's an incredibly beautiful place. There's mountains, there's hand-painted monasteries all throughout the hills. Bucharest is being really revived and becoming kind of a culinary destination. And there's a couple of new hotels in Bucharest, which is sort of why we decided to do Romania this year. But really, there's just tons in Romania that's new to probably a lot of people.
Talk to us, too, about, you know, the places that you thought were maybe unusual when somebody kind of came to you and said, hey, Chris, what about this or that? Like, you thought, oh, I didn't know about that.
Boca Raton was definitely one of those. I had to be sold on
it. It's not going on my list, you know, Chris.
Newport in Rhode Island was also one that I, you know, I was sort of like, well, everybody knows about Newport and what you get when you go there, which is these big, beautiful old mansions. Maybe you spend time on the water sailing. But there's a bunch of new hotels there with some really fabulous restaurants. Opening up, there's a sailing museum there, and also the HBO show Gilded Age, the new Gillian Fellowes show, is going to start. Is actually going to start later this month, so it's going to really draw a lot of attention to the area, and we expect a lot of people to want to go.
I'm going to say when I read that too. I mean, I've done the mansion tours and everything, and I prefer things like Watch Hill and Westerly, which are a lot more kind of mellower and just gorgeous beaches. But it is interesting to see how some of these areas are kind of going through some transformations.
Yeah, yeah. And we have, you know, we have the Catskills on our list, too, which is if you live in New York, you probably know some people who fled for the hills during the pandemic and have been living there. And as a result, there's a lot of restaurants and hotels opening up there. So, you know, the Catskills also doesn't feel like necessarily a fresh place to go, but there's actually a lot of fresh things to do once you're there. Another thing that I was sort of like, was Singapore. And you know, we have a lot of people, a lot of our audience lives and works in Singapore. And, you know, it not a lot of Asia is open to Western tourists right now because of COVID. But Singapore is has been all right to go to. And there's just a lot of wilderness in Singapore. You know, you go to the airport, that Jewel Changi airport, and they have like an incredible inside terrarium with waterfalls. And then actually in the city, there are a couple of hotels that are really sort of nature focused. So even though you're in this big city, Han has these big terraces and a lagoon. The terraces are full of plants, same with the roof. Or you can stay at the Raffles Sentosa, which is a new resort related to the famous Raffles Singapore, which is an all-villa hotel. And, you know, all these little villas are nestled into the trees. So you can actually kind of feel like you're maybe in a more like island vacation than a city vacation.
Hey, Chris, I want to talk a little bit about cruising because in
that's up there with Boca, isn't it? No, just
well,
kidding.
In 2021, you couldn't. I mean, and even now, we hear about cruise ships that are you know, being asked to be put on hold right now. But something that caught my eye in this week's pursuit section is the ability to charter your own cruise in Alaska, and you just get, you know, 11 of your closest friends or family together, and you got your own ship.
Yeah, you know, a lot, you know, when people have sort of a maybe what I would describe as a prejudiced view of cruising, they often think of
Did you say my
Alaska
name there?
Like they think of Alaska as an exception to that because it sort of doesn't feel like you know, maybe all cocktails included, you stop at three beaches and then you just go to the all you can eat buffet all night. It's like you're really exploring, you're seeing glaciers, you're going up close to wildlife. And now some of the new purpose-built ships up there are pretty small. So you can rent out a whole ship, and they're really designed for an intimate experience, you know, just sort of connecting the cities and villages.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rauser for joining us with a look at the latest and greatest from the section this week's issue. Where do you want to go?
You know, I like the idea of this Alaska cruise.
I do hear that it's just stunning.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing.
And catch it before it all
melts. You
know,
my parents went. They didn't take us.
They didn't. Yeah. Did they love it?
They loved it.
Okay. All right, that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks to Chris Rauser, Joel Weber, and everybody at the Business Week team. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Stay safe. This is Bloomberg.